Right, ladies and gentlemen, in case you're wondering who I am, I've just been asked to chair this question session so that none of them cheats by asking, giving themselves all the answers. But before we do, I'm just going to ask each person in the order in which they spoke to give a quick 1 minute summary of what they said, and then open the debate to the floor. I'll do what Eileen said she was. What Eileen was doing when she was chairing questions at one point. If you put your hand up, I will write down either your name, I can't really see anybody, but either your name or some sort of description, which I probably won't read out, and then ask you in the order in which I write you down. So when you put your hand up, and I've sort of made eyes at you, then you can tell that I've seen who you are and written you down in some form, then you can put your hand down. But don't put your hand down till then. That sounded incredibly long-winded.
Okay, thank you, Bob. Well, my argument was an argument on, first off, on the epistemological front. It was an argument against skepticism and against relativism. And on the moral front, it was an argument against moral relativism. So I was arguing that, yes, we might think that truth is just a human construct, that it sort of arises somehow out of the context. So in some ways, it's an argument against the position that Simon was putting forward. But my argument would be along the line that Peter was putting forward, in fact, that to the extent that I believe that there are real truths out in the world, there are real objective truths out there, but what we have is a lot of subjective truths, and we act in the world pragmatically on those subjective truths. So I've then given you some reasons when I started off my talk for why we might preference our subjective truth, and we might then confuse them with being objective truths. But I then try to set out why the idea of scepticism is wrong. We're typically not sceptical when we go out, but we do make mistakes. We make lots of mistakes. But how do we determine between the two of them? And what I've suggested as a route round it is to put into play we put into play our faculty of imagination, and this is about the empathic response that we can have with others, that we can imagine ourselves being in somebody else's shoes. And that's what I was asking you to do. Put yourself in a situation where somebody falsely accuses you. So it's not about truth in the law court, which Jonathan's going to be dealing with tomorrow. It's more about how we get to the truth and whether there are real truths out there.
Right, so in a nutshell, I think I was putting forward Rorty's view that it was theories of truth that actually obfuscated our natural understanding of what truth is, that we know how truth functions, because we can grasp how language reflects what's in the world, and these are the conventions that we use to describe what's in the world, and that actually really mostly what philosophy has done is actually complicated the issue. That truth doesn't actually explain anything further than to the state on top of the statements that we can already make about the world. So in that case, there is a claim for redundancy from a philosophical point of view, but it does serve a useful function in ordinary language.
Insofar as I can remember my talk, the first thing I was claiming was that there are very, very simple cases, like I am sitting, where it seems self-evident to me that whether I am sitting is true is simply made true by the situation, because I can say I am sitting, and if I stand up, the actual physical process of standing up falsifies the sentence. If you accept that, and I don't see how you can fail to accept that, then I'm suggesting that that principle ought to spread to your whole view of how truth works. But of course, I then have a huge claim that all truths are like this and that they all necessitate it. So I'm immediately in trouble embracing all these difficult cases. The middle part of my talk was comparing this with the correspondence theory of truth. And roughly I'm saying that the correspondence theory of truth is a rather precise version of the truth maker. Truth maker is a broad general claim about how we should understand how truth works and what it is. Correspondence theory is a rather precise and more narrow account of what truth actually is. And remember, they're really very different because one is a one place relation and the other one is a two place, or a one directional relation, as I should say. And the other is a two-directional relation of correspondence. So they're really not the same thing at all. And I hope that I managed to distance what I was claiming from the correspondence theory and make truth maker at least more plausible than the correspondence theory, although I'm not totally opposed to the correspondence theory. You'll notice that in Simon's researches, 50% of all philosophers apparently already believe the correspondence theory. So as far as I'm concerned, at least 70% ought to believe truth maker. Otherwise they're crazy.
As much as they believe anything at all.
Yes. And then the last part of my talk was just picking one of the several very difficult cases for the truth maker theory, which is negative truths. So when you say this is not the case, it's not so easy to, you can point to a situation for positive truths, negative truths, and then there's a huge literature on this, and the jury is really out on it, and I'm just toying with the idea that there are sort of primary truths, which are the truths which are made, and if you like, give an account of how the world is, and then all these others are parasitic secondary truths, which are negations of these primary truths or qualifications in some way. There are obviously all sorts of problems with that. I'm really just inviting you to consider the problem.
I just shout. Sorry.
I'll hold it.
No, it's not right. I'm not very good with mics. Unlike the others, I didn't put forward a view on modality. I tried to work through a worry I had about it, inspired by a weekend on necessity and possibility that we had earlier on, where the question wasn't addressed, what makes modal truths true? And I'm still not sure what makes them true. All I did was go through the technical problems that people have had in assigning truth values to statements which don't say anything about what is the case, and to came up with a system, but that system doesn't really tell us what makes modal truth true. Once we think we put a modal statement which is true, or several, then we can put them into a nice theorem in which we can prove. But the question still remains open. Okay.
Right. I've got three questions down here. So first of all, I have three questions down here. If anyone else would like to... If anyone else would like to...
The microphone is off.
If anyone else would like to ask a question, please put your hand up. Right. I'll hand this over. Well, now, first of all, Frank, your question.
This is about yours, Eileen, and what it is that... What is the truth maker for modal statements? I just wonder if it's trite or it's useful to say, it seems to me, just from... Fix it, think afterwards. One might say it's always hypotheticals. So I don't know if you can very quickly get on the screen your list of statements, which includes a number of modal statements.
I'll do my best. The trouble is everyone here is blinded and then I'll start screaming. I'll find that slide. Is that the most useful slide to stick on the board?
From the point of view, my...
Sorry. Nearly there. Here we go.
Yeah. I just wonder if one could apply that to the modal ones.
Well, they're all they've all got a modal component.
Can one say that they're all hypothetical? Number 8 is necessarily even. Well, maybe it isn't a hypothetical.
No, it's not hypothetical.
No.
Hypotheticals. I mean, the logic of counterfactuals, how things might have been, that there are logics to do with that that I haven't touched on. So, which you can do, I think, probably without using possible worlds. So that would be number 3. Number 4,
number 3, one answer might have been, he might have lost it if a hypothetical the Lib Dems hadn't lost half their seats.
Yeah, or if they hadn't nicked them off them. Yeah.
I'm just not quite sure if that's useful, but it's just a last thing for some way of trying to generalise about your question.
So you're saying that I asked 2 questions. One is, why is there a problem technically with modality and people think they've solved that? But the second question, you're thinking that your hypotheticals or your counterfactuals are going to solve the truth maker problem.
Yeah, I thought your last question was, what are the truth makers for?
Yes, it is indeed. Right.
Well,
so
I think that may apply to some of them. I'm not sure how useful it is. But
okay. Well, have a think about it and come back to me. Shall I switch this off again? I can do it fast. Right. As long as that's the only one we need.
Peter.
My question actually does fit quite neatly onto the back of Frank's, which he says, why don't we adopt the old notion of truth conditions but abandon the strict interpretation of that as verificationism? In other words, you say truth makers. Well, why are they needed to make truth? They need it because something is missing, and what is missing is a condition, a physical condition, a condition in the world. You sitting down, for example. That's one thing. So truth conditions can include truth makers. The other thing that truth conditions can do is explain modality in, I think, completely. Because David Cameron might have won the election, could have won the election, if, that's a hypothetical, as Frank is talking about. So if a condition had been supplied, he would have won, he would have lost the election. It is also true that even in the case of necessarily this or necessarily that, if we use a certain number system, then that symbol 8 or the word 8 has to be even. If the word bachelor is used in a certain way, then it has to be a man. If pigs are what they are. I mean, if pigs are animals of a certain kind without wings, then they can't fly. To each of those even necessary statements, there is an implied condition which it would be necessary to explain to a total stranger. And there's another point here. A lot of the confusion arises in cases like might have because of our language. In other languages, that would not be a problem. It would be quite clear that the condition applied in the past, not in the present. So it seems to me truth conditions is a much more useful explanatory term than any of the others. Okay?
I said to Alan that I don't think truth makers and truth conditions are in competition. I mean, if I say Marianne is in this room, I mean, I understand one theory about what that means is that it refers to the condition of how the world would be if Marianne were in this room, which she isn't. right? So you've got the meaning of the sentence, Marianne is in this room, and that's the truth condition theory of meaning. But it's not true, because there's no truth maker. So you've got the truth conditions, but you haven't got the truth maker. So the truth maker is a quite distinct issue from the truth conditions theory of meaning.
No. You haven't got the condition. You haven't got the maker. They're the same thing.
Well, yeah, I would have thought, didn't I give you an example where we've got the condition but we haven't got the maker, I would have thought it wasn't the same thing. I mean, you've got the truth condition, I mean, maybe we're talking about different things, but I mean, if we're talking about Davidson's, you know, and Frege's, I think, theory of meaning, you know, which is that the meaning of a sentence is the truth conditions.
I'm not talking about that.
I wasn't talking about verification. That's a theory of meaning. Well, you know, what do you understand the meaning of a sentence is? If you're not talking about that, I don't know what you're talking about. The truth condition. Yeah. So I don't know what you're talking about.
Anyone else like an answer to this question?
Which is that I couldn't see any difference between what Peter was referring to as truth makers and that well-known duo of evidence and logic. I just didn't see where you got to if you were asking for what made a statement true, other than some empirical observations or a sequence of logic. And, you know, it didn't seem to bracket them together as truth makers, seemed to ignore some distinctions between them, but it didn't seem to add anything to a well-known pair.
Jonathan asked me this one before. My simple answer is that the evidence for a sentence doesn't necessarily make it true. Evidence sort of makes it probable or gives you a reason to think it's true, but it doesn't make it true. So evidence is just not the same as a truth maker. If you like, a truth maker is conclusive evidence, something like that.
Gentleman in the blue check shirt.
I'll stand at the end and try and speak loudly so everybody can hear. Is it not useful to split truth into three different domains? Truth for each type of domain. First one I'd say would be mathematical truth. So if you're following sort of Hilbert, Russell and North and their sort of attempt to formalise and prove mathematics, you've got an understanding of truth there which isn't necessarily the same as you would have with objective truth, which is I think mainly what we've been talking about today. Third type of truth I would suggest is useful to differentiate from the other two is what I might call religious truth. And to give an example of that, let me quote you one of the most famous sentences in the English language. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now that is an understanding of truth which is not an objective knowledge type of truth. And I think we have to take that sort of the moral and ethical truths as different from objective knowledge. And we need to differentiate at all times between those three different types of truth.
Right, thank you. Who'd like to start?
Could I just say a quick comment?
Yeah.
I think one of the things that in my description of what Rorty was seeing as a problem of truth was that a lot of it centred around this idea that that's inherited from sort of Platonic notion that there's this Socratic tendency to see truth as one thing, as a hypostatized sort of reality, and that misses the fact that when we use the word truth, we split it up into these different domains, as you mentioned. So actually, one of the confusions about truth is that it seems to function in different ways, in different, I don't know, for better want of a better term, according to the framework in which, or the paradigm in which it's being used. And I think this causes a huge confusion to the point that this sort of like undermines its usefulness, because also as part of the Platonic inheritance, you could say, well, you know, one of the cliches, what does philosophy do, or what do philosophers do? And there's the love of wisdom thing, but there's also the search for the truth notion. So this is what queers the pitch a little bit, is that actually, what are we all talking about when we use the term? We're not entirely sure. And the relationship to what it is that's under discussion sort of varies depending on what it is the conversation that's being had. And I don't think there's necessarily semantic reducibility from each sort of conversation or conceptual framework or frame of reference in which it's being used to the next. So it becomes a slightly misleading expectation. And the other thing, of course, is you sort of say, well, what do you expect from when we use the notion of the word truth? What are we expecting? What are we hoping for? And we are hoping for something like a statement that accurately describes the state of affairs in the world. But if we're talking about logic, well, that's actually sort of statements about language. That's not about the world. If we're talking about mathematics, truths in mathematics, well, that's statements in mathematical language, not necessarily statements about the world. Although we will apply them to the world in order to explain or interpret things in the world in reality as we understand it. And it was interesting, the sort of like thing about epistemology and ontology that Anne raised, that when we talk about true statements and conveying information concerning the actual state of affairs as it is in the world, the information is epistemic and the state of affairs is ontological. You know, I mean, it seems to be an unavoidable confusion, perhaps, I don't know. But anyway, there you go, I thought I'd just try that.
Can you say that again?
Oh, something about a true statement is one that actually conveys information concerning states of affairs as they are in the world. So one side of it, the information is epistemic,
yeah,
which is an interpretive process of our interaction with reality, and things as they are in the world is an ontological state of affairs, you know, but we can't get beyond the language to know that. Without, you know, there's got to be an interpretive process.
Okay, just a quick comment on that. I just want to say I don't like the way the conversation is going. we seem to be sort of agreeing that there are all sorts of truth, and the word truth has all sorts of meanings, and you make it up as you go along.
No. That's not quite what's being said, but the fact is it's been pointed out that truth functions in different ways in different domains. And that actually is what happens. I think you can't really... I think you're going to struggle to deny that, even as a realist, you know. And I don't think... You see, Rawls is not claiming an anti-realism. He says exactly what you said about truth makers. He says there's language, and there's how the world is arranged. That's Rawls and Davidson's position. Yeah? So, anyway, back to you. I don't want you to accuse me of some sort of weird idealism.
I just wanted to say that this idea of being true within a system, I mean, people typically say, you know, Eileen's introduced S5 logic, and you say things like, in S5 logic, it's true that so-and-so. And in English, we say, bachelors are unmarried men. That's how the word bachelor functions in English. For all I know, the word bachelor is a word in Croatian that means something completely different. So we're perfectly happy with that. But I'm not happy with the idea that you just generalise it to say that every truth is just relative to some little local system. Because when I say pigs can't fly, I don't mean in English pigs can't fly, or in S5 logic pigs can't fly. I mean pigs can't fly.
Yeah. Which is a state of affairs in the world.
Yes.
I would just like to object, or at any rate demur, at the idea of a religious truth as exemplified, or any other example. It seems to me that to use the term truth in a context like that is a rhetorical trick. What you mean is a value, and the the difference can be seen if somebody disagrees when you say it is a truth universally acknowledged. If somebody says, I don't acknowledge it, well, there's an empirical question, how many people actually put their hands up, which is purely empirical, but there is no way of arguing whether you ought to feel it or not, whether you ought to value it or not, except in terms of whatever other values you happen to hold. So I think I would, you know, by all means let those who wish to advance their cause talk of them as truths, but what they mean is values, opinions, feelings and sentiments.
I actually agree with Jonathan for once.
yes, well said.
Well, I sort of agree now with both what Simon and Peter like Peter, I think that there are statements that he can say are genuinely true. There are also, as you point out, sort of domains in which you might use truth in different ways, like mathematical truths and so forth. But nonetheless, I think despite those domains, they land up with just this idea that truth is relative. I don't want to come to that. I want to say that truth is something that is really out there. So the question then comes, well, how can we know that there's truth really out there? You know, if we keep just examining our sentences all the time, we're landing up with all these logical problems, and even mathematics, I want to get into that ground because Mike will start having a go at me, but we land up with these very confused notions about what is going on sometimes. That only the mathematicians can really understand and the rest of us can't. So is there another domain which is a moral domain that is separate from reality? No, I don't want to say that. I want to say that the moral domain and the reality that we confront are one and the same thing. So there are some real truths and there are some real moral truths. That's not to say that any moral statement can be shown to be true or false. But what I'm looking at is issues to do with how do we get to all these different domains of truth? Why do we land up with them? And one of them is, as I've put several arguments through, one of them is this idea of preference, that we simply prefer certain things. We prefer to do mathematics. We prefer a certain line of inquiry. And that's why sort of the statement that I started off with, you know, I ate muesli for breakfast, wasn't of any interest. So you just sort of ignore it, you put it to one side. But if it's something that you're interested in pursuing, then it will be something you're interested in. If you're interested in objective reality, what I'm saying is you can get to it, but you need to use something more than just the analysis of language. We need to put in play this sort of empathic thing that we have, which exists in our faculty of imagination. But that doesn't mean because we're using imagination that we're using false statements. We can know that by understanding our error proneness. Okay, so there's one reality, only one objective truth.
Thank you. I've got four more questions. I'm going to have to go on, otherwise. I've got five more questions left. So I think we must carry on. Anne, you're next.
Yes. I was feeling real sympathy for and trying to put myself in the position of Peter when he said, I don't like the way this discussion is going. And I know exactly what he meant. Together with him, I think, I'm just a realist, you know, a fundamental realist. But the thing is, I think we need to start to try and live, if this is Don Cupid's word, I don't usually choose the words of such folk, try to live outsidelessly. He was doing it in relation to God, you know, there isn't a God that's outside everything. We've got to live outsidelessly. When you talk about the outside world, or there's a truth out there, I don't know where this out is. You know, there aren't any outs. We are all part of the system. So our thinkings, our epistemological thoughts are part of the ontology. They exist. They are there. Mm. Okay, so, Peter, I'm now trying to put myself into a position which I just don't. It's not part of the way I think, you know, I feel I'm turning around in treacle when I try. But would it help your argument if you argued that a state of affairs, in Armstrong's sense, a state of affairs is singular, any state of affairs, whereas what something is singular. It isn't, you know, the world is like that and isn't like this, this cat is like that and isn't like that, a singular thing. Whereas the negatives of this state of affairs are numerous. I mean, they are billions upon. And will that do something for your argument, which, you know, is not what I'm happy to try to opinion of, really. Will that do something for your argument that positive truths and negative truths, you know, they are not, what's the word I want? They're asymmetrical, yes. And so that truths in, you know, I would say in my world would be things that we are necessarily pulled towards as basins of attraction, if you like, maths versus, as basins of attraction because of what we are. I mean, in a very simple sense, if we didn't observe the realities of the world, we'd be extinct, you know, or we wouldn't have come into existence in the first place. Whereas negative things, you know, there is one way at any particular moment that the universe, the biosphere, and the world is. And there are 50 billion trillion ways that it isn't. Does that help you? Would that help your argument at all? No.
Well, I mean, you said a lot of things. I'm only picking out in the middle of it the question of states of affairs. I think I'm using the concept of state of affairs in such a woolly way, deliberately, that it wouldn't matter. I mean, I was just thinking, if I say there are bonfires all over the south of England, you know, obviously I think that's a truth made true by a heap of bonfires, but whether I want to say that's lots of different states of affairs or one wouldn't bother me much, I don't think.
Well, what I'm suggesting is, supposing you made it bother you, and you described that as a state of affairs, bonfires, then it's asymmetrically related to, there are Bilbo Baggins all over the south of England, there are, you know, all those little examples that you gave, which can be multiplied by endless.
There's a view of truth makers which I didn't mention in the talk because I'm not telling I'm buying it, which is David Lewis's, which is that he abandons the notion of specific propositions having specific truth makers and just says all the truths supervene on all of reality. So you don't have to fuss about how they plug into the bits of reality. It's just, if it's true, it will be made by reality. So it's sort of one huge state of affairs making all the truth true. And that's a kind of even weaker version, if you want to go for it. And that's one solution. So then you have one state of affairs, but it would be a huge state of affairs. I don't know if that's...
I thought that the distinction between that you were making between secondary and, as it were, primary truth makers really boiled down to economy. If the statement is Marianne is sitting next to me, then you could go about the evidence in terms of all the other, first of all, trying to find the evidence that there was something called Marianne, and then all the other places that you might be. But it would be a rather uneconomical way of proceeding if, you know, the immediate evidence is that somebody called Marianne is sitting next to me. And equally, if I say there was nobody called Marianne sitting next to me, you could uneconomically go through all the other places where the person called Marianne could be shown to be at the time. But it'd be a damn sight quicker to say all the evidence says that there's nobody called Marianne sitting next to me. It's just a matter of how laboriously one wants to make the truth.
Just answering the thing about the idea of the truth is out there. What I mean by out there is that it's not within language and it's not within
but language is out there, and you're out there. Sorry.
But when we're looking for the truth, yes, language is out there in a way, but we also are looking for those truth makers within what makes something true within a linguistic statement. And part of that, I would say, is to do with our own sort of particular preferences for things. So when we're thinking about a truth maker, yeah, I'm with Jonathan in the sense that there is some evidence out there which makes it true. But when we make the inferential leap, so we go from Marianne's in Scotland, therefore she's not in Oxford. Well, yes, there does seem to be something very true about that, which is made true, I think, both by the state of play in Scotland and by the state of play in Oxford. So those two things are both acting as truth makers in there. But when we start to make the inferential leaps go on further, unless we know what those truth makers are, we can never be assured of our inferential leap. And I think this is what goes wrong with people. When we start to make those inferential leaps, we lose what those truth makers are. We can never know what the truth maker actually is without referring back to some state of affairs in the world. That makes sense.
Does anyone else want to comment?
But it's beginning to occur to me, are we confusing some vague notion of objective truth with perhaps a less vague notion of objective reality? We know that there is reality. I mean, this isn't an anti-realist statement. You know, there is reality, there is the world. But whether the world's true or not, which seems to be something that's been implied, I mean, the world is just how it is. What we say about the world is either true or false. But whether it's absolutely true, I mean, I think in the simple cases of I am sitting in the chair, I am standing up, as Davidson says, I mean, in the plainest cases, that's not a problem. The language that we use means what it is that we're referring to when we use that language. That's this quotationist statement, isn't it? I am sitting in the chair is true if and only if I am sitting in the chair. So, I mean, Rorty's argument is a perfectly realist one, but I do think we're confusing something between reality and truth, and that might be what's maybe confusing us a bit. I don't know.
I'm going to hurry along to the next question.
Just one sentence. Just in response to this quotational thing, I mean, at least I want to say Peter is sitting in the chair is true because of that. I want to be able to leave out the second half of this disquotation game.
Truth is a relation between words, not between things.
Wrong.
I'd like to ask Claudia, how come she feels that empathy is a pathway to this absolute truth? Because however desirable it may be to empathize, it seems to me that the only place it leads is to another point of view. What has it got to do with absolute truth?
Well, that's the negation that I'm actually after. That the thing that we can be absolutely certain about is that we are error-prone creatures. So we can never know what the truth is in itself. We know it's sort of, but we can have intuition that there are things that are true. How do we get to that? So if I'm looking at a statement, you know, Marianne's in Scotland, how do I know that that's true? Okay.
You don't.
So there's always that element there that is in error. So in knowing that there is error, in a way I'm saying that we can also then know that there is something that is true. So I'm then after, how do we get to that? How do we get to this idea of truth? So that's where all the other little arguments you need to look at that come in, that it's, well, something we prefer, something we find useful, all these other things, we confuse those things as being true with the real truth, if you like, the objective truth. but that shouldn't lead us to be sceptical of the idea of objective truth. Because as philosophy has gone along, there are some people who are sceptical about the idea of objective truth, and there are even some people who are sceptical about reality. So, I'm not quite sure
this is it. No, I'm not. I wouldn't be sitting here if it was.
I have two more questions from people who haven't asked questions yet this afternoon. Two more questions from people who haven't asked questions, and a couple from people who have. If anyone else want to answer that last one? No? Right. In that case, we'll go to the gentleman near in the corner.
One word we've not heard, and that's gullible. And a long time ago, I told someone that the edition of the Oxford Dictionary was pulped because they omitted the word gullible. Believe me. But I like the idea. I like the idea of the truth makers, because it's such a malleable thing. Four examples, if I may, very quick ones, of course. When Gosse wrote Omphalos, he was writing really to pull down the truth makers that had been in evidence in evolution and biology and emerging volcanology and so on. He wrote that book with the specific objective of destroying other people's truth makers. When David Bowie created the artist Nat Tate, he provided a whole arena of these truth makers by obtaining photographs of famous artists like Gauguin, and any unknown character in the photograph was told that was Nat Tate, and people latched onto that and believed it because they were persuaded that there was evidence. Benjamin Villanevsky put forward a book called Fragments when he wrote about his experience in Auschwitz during the war as a child, a six-year-old child in Auschwitz. In fact, he was an adoptee sitting in Switzerland with a very comfortable middle-class family, and had no experience whatsoever of any of the camps or any of the persecution. So he had borrowed truth makers to put into his story, and he was held in very high repute until someone actually found evidence to the contrary. And the final one is the students in Australia who created Owen Nally, the Australian poet. And he found that Owen Nally became the truth maker, because Australia felt they were suddenly justified as having a poetic heritage. And they lapped it up. And they couldn't even believe the students when they said, we wrote it. So it's such a malleable idea. But I do think, and as it was pointed out, you know, we're missing these friends, evidence, and what's Ellen Ferris, I think it was. But the idea of having something to make something true, the evidential, is a very, you know, to me, that's one thing I will take away, and I will plagiarise furiously. So I just a slight support this.
Yeah, this should be the last one because we'll never get into dinner if we go on too long.
Well, I've only got one more question. That's Trevor. Trevor at the back. You're the only, I think, last person who hasn't asked a question yet, so it's your turn.
Thank you very much. It's really about truth makers. Peter spent his time arguing for the truth of the truth maker theory. So, what's the truth maker for that claim? Presumably, it's the truth maker theory. But it's only the truth maker if it's true. So, don't we end up with an infinite regress or some kind of hierarchy of truths if you take the truth maker theory?
I'm not answering that. Well, yes, I mean, this is a classic objection, isn't it? Sort of hoist of your own petard sort of job. I mean, what's the truth maker for the truth maker theory? It's the phenomenon of how when we say something is true, you know, you say, well, there's a sentence, and you say, that's true. And you say, well, what makes you think that? And you say, well, you know, da-da-da. So it's, if you like, it's a sort of inductive generalisation about all the occasions of truth I've ever encountered,
that they seem to fall under a nice description of truth making. Obviously, I mean, it's not unreasonable to say if you've got a notion of truth making, you've obviously got a prior notion of truth. I mean, that's roughly your point, isn't it? You've got to have better notion of truth. But I think I've covered myself by just saying, oh, it's a primitive, you know, so it's a primitive truth.
And then what I think that concludes this. Thank you very much for all those questions.